Okay, thank you. I would like to start off by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here, and at the same time apologize for slightly broadening the scope of my talk. The new title is Quantitative Maps of Stellar Substructures in the Milky Way. So some of the main collaborators on this work, is this a laser pointer? So the main collaborators on this talk, I'm afraid it's a bit cut off here, are listed here. So it's a cut off quite substantially. Maybe we can somehow try to reset the... It was working before, yeah. Okay. This is just a brief outline of my talk. I will start with a quick introduction to column magnitude diagram fitting using the MATCH software package. Then I will say something about properties of bound substructures in the Milky Way halo. After that, I will move on to stellar substructure in the disk, and specifically the Canis Major stellar overdensity. Then the third topic will be the original title of the talk, namely a new sparse map of the outer disk of the Milky Way. And the last thing I hope to have time for is constraining the Monostra stream. Okay, I'll just continue for the moment, I guess. So, because stars lie along specific loci in the column magnitude plane, column magnitude diagrams can be used to obtain information about stellar populations such as age, metallicity, distance, binary fraction, etc. And the most simple way of doing this is basically by overplotting theoretical isochrones on the CMDs and comparing them. But if you really want to do this in an algorithmic and quantitative way, the only way to do that is by actually modeling the complete CMD using theoretical templates, which also allows you to use the information from all of the column magnitude space. So over the years, several packages have been developed to do column magnitude diagram fitting, and the package we use is called MATCH, which was written by Andy Dolphin. So the classical way of doing CMD fitting, and also what MATCH was designed for, is basically you have a column magnitude diagram of, for example, a globular cluster or a dwarf galaxy. And an important thing to note there is that in such a case, all your member stars, all the stars you're interested in, are all lying at the same distance, so that all the stars line up nicely in clear features like a main sequence, subgiant branch, red giant branch, etc. So what MATCH does is it compares the observed column magnitude diagram with theoretical models, which are based on isochrones, which are populated assuming a certain IMF and are then convolved with the model for the photometric uncertainties and completeness, etc. And you can also supply a control field to fit foreground stars and background sources, etc. So what MATCH then does is it uses maximum likelihood methods to determine the linear combination of theoretical models that best represents the observed CMD. And it gives you a best fit model and the accompanying star formation history and age metallicity relation. So, for example, the star formation rate and metallicity as a function of time. So basically what you're doing in such a case, when you look at dwarf galaxies, is you're looking at bound structures in the Milky Way or in the local group. And of course, as you all know, over the past few years, the number of these bound structures in the outskirts of the Milky Way has increased significantly, as indicated here by this in this plot from a paper by Walsh et al., where all the recently discovered Milky Way satellites are plotted in red. So these were all discovered in Sloan Digital Sky Survey data. And what we set out to do was to constrain the stellar population properties of these objects using CMD fitting. And because we wanted to achieve a uniform analysis of all these objects, we decided to use the actual SDSS data, because that's a uniform data set in which all of these objects are present. However, One problem you run into, of course, is that these new dwarfs are all either more distant or they're much fainter than the previously known dwarf galaxies. So, for example, if you look at the column magnitude diagram of the globular cluster M13, which is shown here, you have a very high signal to noise. That, and with that I mean in this case that the number of stars you're interested in is much larger than the number of stars in foreground and background contamination. However, when you look at CMDs of these new things, they look quite different. Here's a column magnitude diagram from Bootes 1, which is actually one of the brightest of the new guys. And as you can see, you can actually see that there is some red giant branch there and a horizontal branch there, but the contamination is much higher. And if you look at the column magnitude diagram of LEO 4, it's very hard to see anything at all. So in order to get some reasonable constraints on these very low signal-to-noise CMDs, which basically don't allow you to fit a complete star formation history, we developed the so-called single-component fits, which are illustrated here. So in this case, in the animation here, there are five different population models which have a fixed age, narrow age range, a fixed narrow metallicity range, but different distances. And what you do is basically you take one of these single component models with a single distance, age and metallicity, and for each individual one you determine a goodness of fits, a sort of chi-squared. Yes, I do. In this case, the horizontal branch gives you the distance, indeed. But well, then you would only get a distance. You wouldn't be able to get the metallicity, and etc. Right. So this is just an example where I only vary the distance, but. What we actually do is we also make models for different metallicities and ages, etc. So all parameters are varied. And then for each individual model template, we determine a chi-squared, and that allows you then to find which combination of age, metallicity, and distance best represents the dominant stellar population in the CMB. So these are some results for Bootes 1, COMA, and Ursa Major 2. So the plots here are just the goodness of fit contours as function of metallicity and distance, age and distance, and metallicity and age. And the panels on the right are just the SDSS column magnitude diagrams with the best fitting single component model overplotted in contours. So as you can see for Bootes 1, which has a relatively well-populated CMD, the contours, we get very well-defined contours and we can constrain the parameters very well. But for things like COMA or Ursa Major 2, we get, because there are much fewer stars in the CMDs, we still get quite large uncertainties on all the parameters. And of course, there's also clear degeneracies between different parameters. Sorry? Yeah, this is an age. This is a log scale. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's included in the modeling. Yes. No. No, this is just, we take a column magnitude diagram from the central region, basically. So we're not fitting any structural parameters like density profiles, etc. Just the population properties.
Wouldn't you get a lot more information if you model the background and
It is possible to do something like that, to constrain also structural parameters. But that's something we did in a separate analysis, in a separate paper, which I will come to in a few slides. So for four of these new dwarfs, which contain the most stars in the data, we actually did derive full star formation histories. namely for Butis 1, Ursa Major 2, Leo T, and Canvan 1. And what you see here is that for most of them, they are all dominated by very old, ancient stars, which are also quite metal poor, so in the order of around minus 2. And with the possible exception of Leo T, but this is Leo T seems to be a strange beast. And although most of these things are dominated by very ancient stars, in three cases we do find evidence for multiple populations, namely in Canvan 1, which was also confirmed by deeper LBT data, for Leo T, which has very young stars, which has been forming stars until about 100 million years ago, and for Yuma 2, but that is a result which has not yet been confirmed by deeper data. Yeah, in principle, you cannot completely exclude that there is not some level of low star of star formation in the very youngest bins, because it would only result in a very small number of stars in the CMD. So, in principle, the very small error bars you see in these kind of bins are not formally correct. They're just based on the basically what MATCH does. It fits the data and sees if it needs and to put any star formation there, and if in none of the combinations of parameters it needs to put stars in these very youngest bins, it basically gives very small error bars and zero star formation rates.
So for the chemical abundances, are you really determining at the over
Well, this is basically what MATCH gives. Yes, it always puts the stars in that metallicity bin. Well, of course, when you consider the uncertainties in the isochrones, which there are, I mean, these are also the Girardi isochrones, which we know are not perfect. So, in the table with results in the paper, we add extra uncertainties in these metallicity measurements. Yeah, presumably, yeah. So I'm not going to show all of the results for all of these objects because it would be tedious, and you can look it all up at your convenience in the paper. So another quantitative tool for studying these ultrafaint objects is the maximum likelihood fitting of structural parameters, which is work which was led by Nicolas Martin, who will be here later in the week, I think. And the idea here is that we can determine structural parameters such as ellipticity, half-light radius, and the number of stars in the objects by fitting models directly to the positions of the stars on the sky. So what a lot of people do when determining these kind of structural parameters is they bin the data in order to construct density maps. But when you do that, you're effectively smoothing the data and affecting the structural parameters that you recover. But with maximum likelihood fitting, this is not necessary. So when we did this for these objects, we found an interesting result, namely that the very faint dwarf spheroidals are significantly flatter than the brighter counterparts. So in this plot here are all Milky Way satellites shown as a function of half-light radius and absolute magnitude, with the color scale indicating the ellipticity, with dark blue being round and red being completely ellipticity of one. So as you can see, the globular clusters, which are shown here with the filled dots, are very circular, and the dwarf galaxies are more elliptical. But when you look at the faintest half of the sample and compare it with the brightest half of the dwarf galaxy sample, The faintest ones are significantly flatter. And three of them, Hercules, Ursa Major 1, and Ursa Major 2, have very extreme ellipticities with excess ratios going up to 4 to 1 and 5 to 1. So the question then arises whether these objects are actually really gravitationally bound, or are they, or if they are showing extreme tidal tails, or perhaps actually are tidal debris rather than bound systems. That's another explanation that is possible, but we haven't seen any evidence for rotation yet. Yeah, indeed, they don't seem to be rotating. Yeah, it is. The individual stars or the dwarfs? Ah. Marla? How accurate? Yeah, so we looked at different scenarios of why these things could be so flattened, and we cannot basically exclude any of them. We cannot exclude that it's some kind of disky thing. It seems unlikely, but we cannot exclude it. No.
Just to clarify, have you actually looked for rotation in these? It might be magnitude of 3 cents.
Yes,
and the intrinsic velocity we're looking for is not something.
Typically, there are like up to at most like 20 radio velocities for these kind of objects, I think, right? So. Yeah, no, tidal disruption is definitely alive, I would say. Okay, so the next topic I wanted to talk about was stellar substructure in the disk and the Kenneth Major stellar overdensity. So the Kenneth Major stellar overdensity was discovered in 2004 by Martin et al. Using two mass M giants, and it seems to be the largest substructure at low galactic latitudes. It's illustrated by this figure here, which shows the density of red clump stars, also from Tumas. And what is plotted here is the residual density of red clump stars in the southern galactic disk after subtracting the northern galactic density of red clump stars. And what you see here is a huge blob, basically, is the so-called Kenneth Major stellar overdensity. So it's really a very clear overdensity in the disk. So after this thing was discovered, subsequent deep optical photometry showed that there actually seem to be two different populations present. There's a very strong old or intermediate age main sequence, and on top of that there seems to be a younger main sequence or blue plume. So it is not clear what the origin, what the nature of this overdensity is. There are currently, I think, three common explanations. The first one is that it might be an accreted dwarf galaxy, or the remnant of an accreted dwarf galaxy, which might then be the progenitor of the low-latitude stream or Monostra stream. It might also be, or it has been suggested that it might be nothing, no real overdensity, but actually just something which is an effect of the warp and the flare of the outer disk. And it has also been claimed that the old main sequence that we see actually is made up of stars belonging to a local spiral arm, while the young population of stars belongs to an outer spiral arm. And it's important to know that in that case, the old stars and the young stars in Canis Major would not be at the same distance. So basically, the big question is really whether the Canis Major overdensity is dragged in or kicked out, if it is something that fell into the disk or whether it's something which is intrinsic to the disk. And the question we tried to answer using CMD fitting was whether or not the old and the young stars actually are co-spatial, or whether they are only whether they are at different distances and only seem to be in the same place in projection. So at MPIA we did a large survey using the wide field imager on La Silla of the Canis Major region. This is a plot from a paper by David Butler, and basically just showing star counts in a lot of these fields in this region. And we chose a subset of four of these fields, two really near the center and two more in the outskirts. And these are the column magnitude diagrams. So these are the two central fields. These are the outer fields where the young main sequence doesn't seem to be present, but in the inner fields they are clearly both seen. So, but as you can see, there's a lot of contamination by foreign background stars, because you're looking inside the disk, or very close to the disk of the galaxy. And it's also a problem that, for CMD fitting at least, that these stars in the old main sequence and in the young main sequence might not be at the same distance. So to tackle that problem, we updated MATCH to make it also include distance as a free parameter. So the classical way of using MATCH is basically you assume that all stars are at a fixed distance, and the free parameters are really age, metallicity, and extinction. So the new way in which MATCH was upgraded allows you to specify a certain age metallicity relation, after which the free parameters are age, distance, and extinction. So the way that works is shown here. Basically, this is a column magnitude diagram of the globular cluster M13. When we fit that with the distance fitting mode of MATCH, the result we get looks like this. So on the z-axis, this is the number of stars that is put in bins of log t, so log h, and distance modulus. And here all the stars are neatly piled up at the distance modulus of M13. Well, this is the same for the globular cluster NGC 6229, which is more distant, and all the stars pile up there. When you now combine these two CMDs like this, and you fit it with MATCH, then it nicely recovers the two different peaks in the distance distribution. So we did this to the two central fields in Canis Major, and like I said, you have to you should specify an age metallicity relation. So we can choose to either make the young stars metal rich or metal poor, for example. So the metallicity of the old stars is approximately -1, which is what we assumed in this case for the young stars. But if you assume that the young stars belong to an outer spiral arm, you would think they would be much more metal rich. So here, in this case, we assume the metallicity of -0.3. And in both cases, you can get very good fits, which are statistically equally good fits to the data. And the interesting thing, then, is that if you assume that the young stars are metal-rich, they are put at a larger distance than the old stars. Well, if you assume that the young stars have the same metallicity as the old stars, all of them line up at the same distance. So the photometry alone is not enough to decide whether or not these two populations of stars are actually at the same distance or not. So spectroscopy to get metallicities, etc., would be needed to decide on that. So then the original topic of my talk, a new sparse map of the outer disk of the Milky Way. So studying the Milky Way disk is, of course, as we all know, difficult because of the enormous sky area that is covered by the disk and because there's a lot of dust everywhere. So at least the first problem, namely the large sky area that you need to cover, is starting to get solved with the large surveys that are being done these days. The first attempt to really image very deep into the disk is the Segway imaging survey, and which contains a lot of 2.5-degree wide scans done with the Sloan telescope, which cross the galactic disk. So this is not a completely up-to-date plot. I think it's from January 2008, but you can see in green the imaging scans that had been done in January, and I think now the imaging program is completely finished. So these are some CMDs as an example from the stripe at galactic longitude of 94 degrees for different latitudes. So latitude is indicated in each panel, as well as the EB minus V reddening according to the Schlegel maps. And these column magnitude diagrams have been de-reddened using the Schlegel maps. And as you can see, this is not completely perfect, because in this case, clearly the de-reddening is not sufficient, and you cannot use these data to do anything, basically. If you go further away from the disk where the reddening is less bad, it gets better. But in general, we try to avoid regions where the reddening is higher than 0.25 magnitudes. So these CMDs are typical for the kind of data we are using. And interestingly, and these two CMDs are the kind of substructures that we are actually interested in, such as the Sagittarius stream and the Monostra stream. So as you can see, you can kind of squint and see them, but these kind of substructures that we in the disk or in the galaxy that we're interested in are very low signal to noise. So what we are doing is we are using the distance fitting mode of MATCH to basically go all along these scans which cross the Milky Way and try to get a 3D, a three-dimensional map of stellar mass density of the galaxy. So we did this in two ways. First, we used a very narrow color range in the CMDs and used a single metallicity and age population to basically shift a main sequence along the distance axis and basically map out the number density of main sequence stars. And secondly, we tried to take it one step further and used three different populations, a thick disk-like population, a halo-like population, and a very broad population to increase the fit quality and to be able to make sure that we are able to deal with background sources and etc. And this multiple population fits, we use a wider color range because the only information you can get on different populations is basically in the main sequence turn-off stars. So you have to make sure that we included the turn-off stars in our color range. So these are some of the results. Basically, these panels show for the different stripes, the different latitudes, the stellar mass density. So it goes basically from high mass density to low mass density, and as you can see, of course, close to where we are, the mass density is very high, and then as you go out into the halo, the mass density decreases. Here is the same, but now color-coded with what kind of population is present at each location. So red is the thick disk-like population, blue is the halo-like population, and as you can see, everything behaves as we hoped, namely the nearby stuff, which is mainly thick disk stars, is fit by the thick disk population, and the halo is fit by the halo population. So no surprises there. So in order to bring out substructures within these maps, we first had to fit a smooth model to the data, which we could subtract from it. So the kind of model we try to fit to these data basically consists of a thin disk and a thick disk, just exponential disks, and a power law halo. And the best fit parameters we get when we do this are listed here. And so interesting to notice, especially what we get for the halo, we find that it's quite round. Apart from that, the other parameters are not very surprising. So when you subtract this smooth model from the mass density maps, this is what you end up with. So basically, dark is over densities, light gray is under densities. And as you can see, a lot of substructure pops up. So very obvious examples, for example, is here the Sagittarius stream, which you can actually see that it's split into two different parts. And it's distant here and comes closer as we go to smaller longitudes. Other thing here, for example, is also Sagittarius, and there's a lot of stuff at low latitudes. This is basically the original detection of the Monoceros overdensity. And the multiple population fits allow you also to see certain differences between the populations of different overdensities. Okay, so then the final topic is constraining the Monoceros stream, because one of the main reasons why we went to all this trouble was because we wanted to see if we could identify new detections of the Monoceros stream that were not known yet. So the Monoceros, or low latitude stream, is a large stellar structure which seems to encircle the entire Milky Way at low latitudes. And it was when it was first detected, it was suggested to be a stream of tidal debris, so a stellar stream basically. So in these two lower panels here, this is galactic longitude versus latitude, are two models that have been made for the low latitude stream, one by Peña-Rubia et al. And one by Martin et al. And the red lines here indicate the Sloan, the Segway imaging scans. So as you can see, the Monoceros stream looks very different between these two models in the area that is observed by the Segway scans. So in principle, we should be able to distinguish between these two models. However, it is not really certain that the Monoceros stream really is a tidal stream, as it could also be, as has been shown recently in papers by Kasantzidis et al. And Younger et al., that material from the thin disk can be expelled from it and form circular structures in the outer disk. So this is a plot from Kasantzidis et al., which starts out with a flat disk, and by interactions with satellite galaxies, which are expected in lambda CDM cosmology, you form circular, it's probably not very clear here, but you form circular structures in the outskirts, which also are clearly can extend out of the plane of the disk. So that would be a different explanation for the Monoceros stream. So when you have these maps of overdensities, you can go and look at low latitudes and see what kind of overdensities you see. So when you do that, this is just some examples of the strongest overdensities, you can try to map out the whole structure of the Monoceros stream. And once you have identified these pieces of the Monoceros stream like this, you can go in more detail, look in more detail at the column magnitude diagrams to determine or to constrain parameters such as distance and age better. So this is a column magnitude diagram at the place in the LS178 stripe. So basically it's this overdensity here. And as you can see, it's a very strong main sequence overdensity. So when you select stars in a box on this overdensity and plot the stars in a color plot, then you can overplot isochrones, and metallicity separates out very nicely. So you can see that, for example, this strong overdensity is best fit by a fairly metal-rich isochrone. You can also overplot isochrones of different ages and see the difference in turnoff, and then put some constraints on the ages of these overdensities. And finally, you can plot the overdensities you find in longitude versus latitude, for example, or longitude versus distance. This panel is for detections above the plane, and this for below the plane. And you can compare that with, for example, the model by Peña-Rubia et al. And you can start to, we haven't done this in detail yet, but you can start to see how well the detections actually fit the models. And perhaps people can try to make better models of the Monostra string. So basically what it comes down to is that we have a lot of detections for different bits of the stream. We find very different metallicities. Some seem to be very metal rich, some seem to be quite metal poor. And in the strongest overdensities, we see no evidence for very young stars. And since my time is up, I'll just leave you with my conclusions.
Questions? So the fact that you can derive star formation histories and metallicity evolution for the outer-faint dwarfs is remarkable using SDSS data. But I think the accuracy of that method depends very strongly on the depth of the photometry. And in your paper, you show examples of six Kabo clusters for which you derive exactly the same star formation history as for these dwarfs. And you also derive a metallicity spread, which you would not really expect in those Kabo clusters. Are you worried that you're pushing the method beyond its limits, beyond where it really applies?
We are definitely trying to take the method as far as we can. That's true. But I didn't understand what you meant with unexpected metallicities in the globular clusters.
Well, you have a spread of metallicities, and you have quite an extended star formation that you derive for global clusters. You don't expect that for global clusters.
But that's inherent to the method, that you get some spread into adjacent metallicity bins or age bins. It's basically unavoidable.
But do you believe then in the results you derive for the ultra faint dwarfs?
Well, for the ultra faint dwarfs, you have to take the same things into account as for the star formation histories you get for these globular clusters. You have to take into account that there is always some bleeding into adjacent bins.
A technical question about Sloan colours. Match uses isochrones, is that right?
That is correct.
So what synthetic, are you using synthetic stellar atmospheres on top of those? How do you turn them into colours? You're working in U-G or G-R, and the isochrones are in effective temperature.
Match only uses colour magnitude diagrams, not colour diagrams. So this is what I showed here with the color plots. This is not something that is done with MATCH.
Yeah, but how about just the color magnitude diagrams?
Mm-hmm.
How are the isochrones calibrated?
These are we just used the basic Girardi isochrones.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So in one of your earlier slides, you've shown that color magnitude diagrams of some of these dwarfs can look pretty scrappy. Are you worried about contamination from foreground stars, and could those explain some of these apparent bursts of late star formation in these dwarfs?
In principle, that is a worry. So we do provide match with a control field to take care of these kind of things. But if you would have two foreground stars, which exactly lie somewhere where match can put a young main sequence through it, then that can definitely be a problem. Yeah. So that's statistically it's accounted for. Yeah. That is true. Yeah.
So you said that the new data can help shed light on the origin of the Monoceros stream. Can you tell us whether it does shed light?
Well, as I mentioned, we haven't done this in detail yet. But when you do look at these kind of comparisons, and one of the things you immediately notice is that while some parts of the stream seem to be kind of reasonably fit by the models, other parts are definitely not. So I think that these detections that we are getting will definitely be very useful for improving the models that there are for the Monoceros stream, because I think the models that are in place now are definitely not agreeing very well with the data.
When you applied match to the distant Sloan data to look at the properties of the dwarf spheroidals, did you use it? Did you look at the known dwarf spheroidals that had already been found, or did you apply it to all the Sloan data and thereby recover the same set of dwarf spheroidals that had already been recovered?
So, in fact, we did both. What I showed is basically where we took CMDs, where we knew that there were dwarf galaxies, and just try to constrain the population parameters. But in principle, it is possible to use match to detect objects, which is also something which we did, which seems to work reasonably well.
So if when you applied it to all the Sloan data, did you find exactly the same set of dwarf spheroidals that everybody else had found?
At that time, yes. So some of the most recent ones, like Leo 5, we didn't detect. Booties 2, we didn't detect. Like that, no. So it's not the best way, I think, to do this. Because the way we did that, we basically only looked in column magnitude space, and we weren't very sensitive to the sizes of the objects. So what you would ideally do is have a combination of looking for clumps of stars and stars lying along certain loci in the column magnitude space.
Sorry to jump you around, but back to the stream. Mm-hmm. I believe that there are some globular clusters which are clearly identified with the Sagittarius stream. Are there any globular clusters that you can even remotely associate with the Monoceros stream?
Yeah, there are.
And what are their properties compared to your model?
So I don't know that from the top of my head, but there are, I think, three or four globular clusters which are claimed to, or which people say that they might be associated with with the Monoceros stream. Yeah. No, there are also globular clusters, I think. Yeah.
I can't read very well your color coding there, but one of the ways of telling whether this is really a disruptive stream or just, you know, a perturbation to the disk would be to look at the angular extent of the feature, in the sense that, you know, if it's really something that's been destroyed in a circular orbit, then most debris will be around the circle, around the whole galaxy, whereas just a perturbation to a small fraction of stars will probably show only as on a particular arc. Is it clear that there is a finite angular extent to this feature at a particular distance or from this data or not?
So, well, one problem is, of course, that this is these stripes are separated by 20 degrees, mostly. So we don't have a continuous map. And then also, because of where the Sloan telescope is located on Earth, these scans only are done between longitudes of about 50 degrees and 250 degrees. So we cannot go all the way around the galaxy. But, you know, once things like Pan Stars and SkyMapper are going, then it should be possible to map.
But you detect it over all the longitude range, so you could detect it. Is that correct? Or
we detect stuff in almost any, but it's very difficult because there are these 20 degree gaps between the scans. It's very difficult to say, like, this is really a something we see here is really a continuation of what we see here.
But I thought you had some more information from MATCH that, you know, tells you whether these populations are consistent. For example, you should see a consistency.
Yeah.
I guess so, I was aiming to that.
For example, these very strong detections you see in several of the stripes that you see here, they all seem to have the same metallicity, for example. Yeah. But that those kind of things we can constrain.
Any more questions?
You showed some ellipticities for globular clusters and dwarfs, and in general, the globular clusters had lower ellipticities. Were they measured in the same way?
So, no, I don't think so. No.
Well, we have time for one more question.
So how much, in a lot of these globular clusters, they're taken from outer fields, and there is a strong population of blue stragglers that often occurs near the center of these things. So if you went to something like an open cluster or some of the globular clusters that have really strong blue straggler populations, would you see a young population of blue plume in those? I mean, how much do you worry that some of your blue plume is built by just blue straggler sequence?
Yeah, so that is true. Let me see if I can quickly go there. So in these three cases where we do see young stars, in the case of Leo T, it's clear when you look at the CMD, these are very young, very bright stars. So that's without a doubt. In the case of Canvan 1, we also obtained data, deep data with LBT, which confirms our suspicion that it really is a young population, because these young stars seem to be very clumped and offset from the center, which is something you wouldn't expect for blue stragglers, for example. Just in the case of Ursa Major 2, it hasn't been confirmed yet in any other way, as far as I know. So I wouldn't bet my life on the fact that this really is a young population. But in these two cases, it seems to be absolutely true. Yeah.
If I can say something about blue stragglers in dwarf spheroidals, we wrote a paper with Yazan Momani is first name, and we published last year, and we showed that there is a trend in blue stragglers inside the dwarf spheroidals, and in the sense that the number of blue stragglers compared to the HB stars is increasing, going to lower luminosities, total luminosity of the galaxy. So the fainter one should have more blue stragglers than the bigger one. And in fact, this reverse trend is working for all the dwarfs that we have that we know now. Of course, these smaller galaxies, we have not included yet in this trend, but it's clear that there can be a contamination from blue stragglers.
Yeah, so it would be very interesting to have a very close look at Ursa Major 2 to see exactly what's going on there.
Okay, well, let's thank all of this morning's speakers again. And we break now for lunch. We meet back here at 2 p.m.